From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. We'll have a roundup today of international news focusing on Asia, the Middle East, and Afghanistan. Then an actor in the touring production of War Horse gives credit to the puppeteers that create the horses.
Being able to see what they do as actors, as puppeteers, is nothing short of a miracle. They are creating life on stage. And there's not very many opportunities, maybe even zero, for a lot of people to see such thing like that.
Wild Space Dance Company rehearses for the next site-specific program, and Pulitzer Prize-winning Paul Harding returns with a simple, difficult subject in his latest novel.
If the basic premise of the novel is a parent losing his only child, you take one false step in any direction and you have maudlin, melodramatic, sentimental hogwash.
Lake Effect comes your way next. First, the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in. We are less than 2 weeks into 2014, and it's already been busy on the international news front. A former U.S. Defense Secretary is making news for his forthcoming memoir that's critical of his former boss, the current President of the United States. Plus, there are signs that the Egyptian people may be adapting to the country's less democratic military leadership. But our foreign policy contributor Art Sear looks first at Asia today, where a former NBA basketball player is continuing his unique and unlikely role as a would-be ambassador to North Korea. Dennis Rodman and a group of fellow former NBA athletes played a game this week in North Korea in honor of leader Kim Jong-un's 31st birthday, much to the chagrin of both government and basketball officials in this country. But Sear, who's director of the Clausen Center for World Business at Carthage College, tells Lake Effect's Mitch Teich that despite the swell of publicity surrounding Rodman's link with the closed-off country, the trip itself probably has little impact on the frosty relationship between Washington and Pyongyang.
I think there's curiosity and sensational media, mostly tabloid value, but no, I don't think so. And in fact, there are indications that Kim Jong-un and coterie, the ruling clique in Pyongyang, North Korea, they've been keeping their distance personally from Dennis Rodman, which is certainly a good sign of good sense on their part.
Is this, as far as foreign policy goes, essentially just a weird sidebar?
Yes, I think it's a weird sidebar. Celebrities can play a role in foreign policy. Charles Lindbergh, for instance, greatly complicated U.S. foreign policy thanks to his, in some ways, favorable views of the Third Reich many, many years ago. In more recent times, it's hard to think of a sports figure or an entertainment figure. They're always in the news and wannabe, but it's hard for me to think of a comparable example of someone, including in, you know, very tangible aviation and engineering and science professions who've had a major impact on foreign policy. And he certainly doesn't qualify. But we live in a celebrity culture. The media is, if anything, even more celebrity-focused in terms of what should be the serious media than was the case in the 30s and 40s and 50s. So I think he's a good indicator of how things have changed for better and for worse. But I don't see him having any influence, and I'm very glad that even the Pyongyang regime, which seems to be removed from reality, is not giving him a lot of personal attention.
It's interesting, though, because you think back to the days of the Cold War and the Soviet Union, and we think of the cultural exchanges, which may have thawed the relationship just a bit. Can culture play any role, do you think, in changing our relationship with North Korea, or is it really just such a personality issue coming from the leadership in Pyongyang?
Well, that's a very interesting and very important point. I hadn't thought of it that way, but you're making a very important distinction between the kind of desperate celebrity, where I'd put Mr. Rodman seeking attention and probably income at this point in his career, and more serious cultural and educational exchanges. During the height of the Cold War, Dwight Eisenhower and associates initiated some athletic exchanges, but especially cultural exchanges. So the New York Philharmonic would go to Moscow, and Leonard Bernstein, the right kind of celebrity overseas, would have a very positive impact, along with his associates. The Bolshoi Ballet would come to the U.S. That and scientific exchanges. There was something much less visible called the Pugwash Conference. But without compromising national security or nuclear secrets or anything else, scientific exchanges were encouraged by the Americans. And like a lot of other things that Ike did, an underappreciated president at the time, increasingly appreciated, at least in the intellectual communities, those were very, very effective ways of encouraging understanding between the two sides, because music and the arts are a universal language, and science especially is a universal language. That's a very good point, Mr. Tyke. I should be interviewing you.
But you would make the argument that Dennis Rodman is no Leonard Bernstein.
No, absolutely not.
Well, you mentioned...
And I'd hate to see him in a ballet costume.
You mentioned Dwight Eisenhower, and that's as good a segue as any. You have in the past compared the leader of South Korea to Dwight Eisenhower, just in terms of being kind of an under-the-radar, quietly competent kind of leader. The president of South Korea held a news conference on Monday. What, if any, news came out of that?
The good news is no news. Park Geun-hye, she symbolizes important things, just as Eisenhower, for the average person at home and abroad, I think very much personified the best aspects of the U.S. And he used that very shrewdly to further his fantastically successful political career. She personifies in many ways the remarkable changes in South Korea. Her family history is in some ways tragic. She became the first lady of South Korea. Her father was Park Chung-hee, longtime, very strong and feared dictator. Her mother was killed by an assassin from North Korea who was aiming at him. She, as a very young girl, I think she was 11 or 12 or something, undertook the ceremonial aspects of that very traditional society. The fact that she's a woman, the fact that she won in an open and free democratic election, the fact that she personifies all kinds of progressive things, especially as a counterpoint to her effective but very autocratic father, I think shows a lot of change in South Korea.
Well, and China's obviously the giant in Asia, and for years we've heard about our trade relationship with China and the kind of outsized importance it's taking. Japan has been a historical major trading partner of the United States. Why would you argue that South Korea is so important to our foreign policy and world trade?
They're a particularly close ally of the United States, dating from the Korean War, 1950 to 53, a very bloody war, a war that Eisenhower very effectively ended very quickly, but one that had drained sort of the emotional as well as economic resources of the United States. It fostered anti-communist hysteria in this country in the McCarthy period. It made the Cold War, which had been focused on Berlin and Germany, global. It also cemented a tremendous close alliance between the U.S. and South Korea. I first became aware of South Korea in a direct way in the early 70s when I was in the U.S. Army. The ROK Army, Republic of Korea's Army, is a very, very ferocious population of warriors. They maintain 50,000 troops throughout the height of our involvement in our long Vietnam War, only because of tremendous affinity for the United States. And I've, over the years, been impressed at how close this relationship is and how much South Korea represents a phenomenal success story for the people there as well as the people here. We Americans should be very, very proud of what has been accomplished in South Korea, starting with that terrible war.
Let's shift to the Middle East, if we could. And there are reports out of Egypt this week. I think the Washington Post reported, for starters, on signs that the population in Egypt is kind of getting used to the military leadership that has taken over and kind of turned back, dialed back the, right, the democratic progress that had been made, and signs that people are choosing that stability over the freedoms that they had fought for and at least briefly enjoyed. What are you seeing out of Egypt, and how does that speak to the overall legacy of the Arab Spring?
The Arab Spring is still unfolding. I think it's part of a global movement toward democratic and free economic institutions that South Korea especially represents, but it's a worldwide phenomenon. Americans want instant results, and we tend to think that everybody in the world wants to be an American. I believe strongly that was part of our problem in Vietnam, which we mentioned a minute ago, and in our invasion of Iraq, which I think was misguided. Coptic Christians, one litmus test, a sort of canary in the coal mine, if you will, in the Middle East is how Christians are treated. And the generals have been rather restrained. They say, at least, they give lip service to returning to democracy at some point. No countries in that region have a strong democratic tradition outside of Israel and Turkey. So I think it depends. We should pay close attention to how minorities, especially Christian minorities, are treated in Egypt and elsewhere, and see how things unfold. But we should not in any way do what we like to do, which is lecture other people and send anything beyond economic and very physical aid and assistance. We shouldn't intervene in human terms politically in Egypt or anywhere else in that region.
Well, what about Egypt's leadership role in the broader Middle East? How is that being affected by having the military leadership in place there?
That's a very good question. It's kind of a return, as you were indicating, a kind of a return to the past. Geographically, they're extremely important because of the Suez Canal. Geography remains fundamental to international relations. And again, in contrast to our British friends and a number of others, we Americans often, because we're so in love with technology and I believe so full of ourselves historically, we tend to often to minimize the importance of geographic factors. But the Middle East, and especially Egypt because of the Suez Canal, will continue to be in physical terms important for us. One important piece of good news is the remarkable energy revolution going on in this country. Our European friends will continue to be dependent on Mideast oil, but we are becoming far, far less dependent on foreign oil than we were. We're returning to a situation before about 1960, 61, when we had a lot of energy independence in terms of petroleum.
One more foreign policy development in just recent days, I think, bears talking about, and that is, you know, we don't normally talk about the publishing world in this segment, but why is a memoir that is not even out yet causing such a buzz in foreign policy circles?
Robert Gates, former defense secretary, his new memoir. Well, it's been leaked a lot to the media. He made what in retrospect is a telling public statement when he was leaving as Secretary of Defense. He said, "I'm not going to comment on my tenure. I want to do that when I'm going to get paid for it." I believe it's unfortunate that he's done a book that apparently reportedly deals so much with personalities. I think he's hurting himself in the long term. I'm sure he'll make a lot of money and generate a lot of controversy, but I'm sorry about that myself.
The flap in question this week has been his recounting of kind of a lack of conviction by President Obama over his own Afghanistan policy.
I don't think that's really a surprise. That's what the media has seized on. What's been quoted in the press, Bob Woodward, who's incredibly effective at getting sources to talk to him, senior people to talk to him now since Watergate for many years. I have read what he's written on the subject for the Washington Post, and Gates focusing on personal foibles of these colleagues of his, I think, is much more noteworthy and very, very unfortunate.
Given that the President Obama obviously cannot run for reelection, would you imagine that a kiss and tell memoir is likely to have any kind of legs as far as impact on elections down the road?
Probably not. I think these kinds of books have a very short shelf life and tend to have very little impact, especially when you do something like this when the president's still in office. Gates isn't by any means the first to do this. I can't think of anyone who's profited.
I would imagine he'll have plenty of appearances on talk shows, though.
Probably. He's taken a good new job, head of Boy Scouts of America, which is certainly commendable. Gates is about 70 years old. As you get older, I think there's a lot of benefit to being around young people. I greatly value my involvement with Carthage College for that reason, and I fear that Mr. Gates, far more senior and visible figure than me, most people, I think perhaps he's becoming too much of a grumpy old man, and I hope being around younger people at the Scouts will be helpful for him. That's
all right.
about all I can say on the subject.
Art Sear, thanks.
Thank you. It's always a tonic, Mitch. I really mean that.
Art Sear is Clausen Professor of Political Economy and World Business and Director of the Clausen Center for World Business at Carthage College in Kenosha. He's our occasional foreign policy contributor, and he spoke with Mitch Tyke. Although she says she's retiring, Deb Lowen of Wild Space Dance Company keeps making work in unexpected places around Milwaukee. We'll talk with her about her upcoming program, Sight Readings, when Lake Effect returns next on WUWM. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. The clue is in the name. For almost three decades, Wild Space Dance Company has been making site-specific dances that exist in both our exterior and interior wild spaces. As Paul Kosodowski writes in the latest issue of Milwaukee Magazine, dance performances for Loewen are all about location. From the Linden Sculpture Garden to the Pritzlaff Building to the Menominee Valley Three Bridges Park, there doesn't seem to be a place in the greater Milwaukee area that doesn't at least pique her interest. At the end of this month, Loewen will showcase new work in UWM's Institute of Visual Art, or INOVA, at Kenilworth Square. Site readings is being created in conjunction with UWM's visual arts and dance departments, and it will occur in the galleries. I reached Loewen by phone during the depths of the recent freeze, and she told me how this newest work came to be.
I was approached by the UWM dance department last spring, and they were wondering if I would be interested in doing a collaborative project with INOVA and UWM dance students, and also Wild Space. I have done two earlier projects at the original or the old INOVA gallery, which was on Downer Avenue, and I loved working in the gallery spaces, and it was two different floors, and we did some really fascinating projects there. And in some ways, it helped hone my skills for audiences moving and seeing things that are happening concurrently, and looking at things that are in rooms. So when I was asked by the department chair, Simone Farrow, if I would be interested in this, I said, oh my goodness, absolutely. Also because I love the new INOVA space in the Kenilworth Building.
Oh, it's fantastic space for just about anything you want to do.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It has this history of this old architecture, and the ceilings are really tall. And the rooms are larger, so I felt that I could move an audience through. And the timing of the kind of show they were interested in doing and my being in there, we worked on that pretty carefully. They have a show with video artists that opens this Thursday, and it's a marvelous show. I just got to see some of the clips yesterday when I was in there rehearsing. But the lovely thing is that there's not stuff around. It's a show that... when the video is shut down, walls have not changed, and the dancers can move around and through the space. It's unusual for INOVA to do this kind of a show. They often have paintings and sculpture, and they're very adventurous in terms of the kinds of shows they have. So I'm always waiting for a downtime when I can do something in the space that feels like it's going to work artistically for me. So that kind of was the crux of it. And just, again, being... I'm enthralled with new spaces and new complications, I think I would say, because I like the complications. Also looking at what happens when people come into a gallery for a gallery experience, which is they wander and they stop and they wander and they stop and they might talk a little bit, but they're pretty much unguided. And then you have a confluence of my audience who comes to things in theaters or they come to other dance events, and they... are looking to, they have an understanding of all the different things going on, and they will probably spend more time with different kinds of events. So, and that's the nature of dance audience. You pop them in the theater, and they stay there.
Right, right. They're not moving normally.
In this show, everything is moving.
So audiences are moving, the dancers are moving, and the art is moving.
Yes, and the material are the dancers. And also I'm working with two artists from Milwaukee. Tom Bamberger is doing a paired short movie. It's very abstract, and so I'm using his work, and also Jake Fuller, who is a local filmmaker.
And you've worked with Tom before.
I've worked with Tom before, and this is very similar to these are new films that I haven't worked with these films, but it's people will be familiar with his slow movies that move forwards and backwards in time, and then it gets very phasic. They're lovely, and what I love about them is that they're abstract. So they provide a field for the dancers to move in a landscape. And they're lovely by themselves, and they're also lovely with the performers.
That's one of the things I really enjoy about your work so much, is that layering, is that the individual components can be appreciated on their own, but they are greater than the sum of their parts when you put them all together.
Oh, well, thank you. The layering is a very important part of making the work, and it's what also keeps me kind of on my toes through the rehearsal process, because I see something, and then, for example, the the dancers are working with. We're working with a series of drawings. I made some drawings on cards, and all the dancers got to choose which drawings they wanted to use, and they're just lines and curves and shapes. And I meant them as short sentences for people to make these short sentences or develop a language vocabulary that was based on that. But then in the process of doing that, then I asked the dancers to perform that material as though they're on a floor in the corner on the ceiling, perform the phrase as though they're moving in between two people, perform the phrases as if they're next to someone or as though the phrase is outside of the building or as though the phrase is missing something. So you start with something that feels very concrete, and then I like to add these tweaking layers so that you see something that's actually transforming right in front of you, and you understand something's transforming, but you don't necessarily need to know why or what is driving it.
Do you feel that the audience members at that time will help drive whatever changes, or is the choreography going to be pretty fixed by the time you add the moving audience?
Oh, I think it's going to be a combination of both. I think the dancers are going to want it to be pretty fixed, and it's going to be impossible. I keep saying, don't hold on to what you think you need to right now, because I want all the dancers to move through the different spaces. So even that, we don't know how long it will take. We can't rehearse it very often because it involves turning an alarm off, and the audience presence will have a huge impact on how long it takes to move from one space to the next. And I also have the dancers will have tasks to do on their way. One of my thoughts was, what happens if you perform this phrase only for people who are wearing green? Which means there's a certain, we shift and the dancers are hunting the audience as opposed to the audience hunting for something in the dance.
That doesn't usually happen. It's usually the audience is receptive,
right.
You know, and or not, but you hope that they are. But they're not actively participating. They certainly haven't been part of your rehearsal process, but they are part of the whole that will eventually be created.
Right. I even when I was rehearsing yesterday, I had half the performers moving, and then I had the other performers with me be audience. And then I would say things. What happens? How does it make you feel when you actually try to get an audience member involved in this duet? What does that mean?
And what were people saying? What were they?
Well, they didn't say. I didn't ask them to say anything.
Okay.
So what was interesting was just watching people move and seeing someone who's like, "What are you talking about?" That kind of audience person, or someone else jumping in and starting to move as well because there's that kind of audience person. And it was just kind of just to give the performers a sense that there is going to be another moving component, which is the audience.
Right. That's the part that is the unknown.
That's the unknown. That's the excitement, and that's also the terror.
You've done these kinds of site-specific things in lots of different spaces. How are you feeling about this one? Is this a space that you would want to revisit?
Oh, yes. This is a really beautiful space, and I think it's a space that that could actually... It would be really fun to have different kinds of performance activities in it because it's, I mean, you could do something that was a very specific, a reading of something, a play of some sort in a space, or music. I know that they've had one or two music events there, and the music sound support is just, I mean, it's just such a live, loud room that it's actually problematic for me in some ways in that I can't have sound in every room. That's different because it'll just be muddy. But I know that there have been some performances there, and I think it's just such a beautiful space to spend time in. I've really been happy to be there and to learn about, you know, there's all these little nooks and crannies, and that's also, you might come around a corner and there's an empty space, and if you move your head in, you might find a dancer tucked back there. But I'm very excited about it. It's one of those things where I have no idea what the audience is going to, what their response is going to be and how they are going to, you know, settle into things. Audiences go to art museums. They don't spend more than, what is the average, 10, 15 seconds in front of an artwork.
Right. It's not very long.
Something really shockingly low. It's just, and so this is interesting because I'm also wanting them to play with that idea. So I'm going to have some text plates on the wall in places, and which will encourage and make the audience move into a space and read something. But the reading of whatever they're reading might be something as cryptic as, this seems like this event needs more information. Please sign the next text plate. So, that, you know, things like that where I'm playing with that idea of the text plate is supposed to give you more information, but it doesn't really give you information about what the work is. History, it gives you some details, but it has nothing to do with the materials that you're, that have been organized for you to look at. So it, in some ways, I'm kind of playing with that. I want there to be some whimsy in this event.
Well, it sounds like there will be.
That's going to be fun.
Well, Deb, as always, it's such a pleasure to talk to you, and I'm glad you haven't retired yet.
No, I haven't retired yet.
You keep threatening to, and we're very glad that you aren't.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
And best of luck with it.
Yeah, thank you.
Deborah Lowen is director of Wild Space Dance Company. Their show, Sight Readings, opens at the end of this month at UWM's Institute of Visual Art at Kenilworth Square. Lowen is also the subject of Paul Kosodowski's article, Where the Wild Things Are. It's in the current issue of Milwaukee Magazine. Another kind of movement has taken over the Marcus Center this week as the actors, puppeteers, and horse-sized puppets of the show War Horse perform. We'll chat with a couple of them when Lake Effect returns in a moment on Milwaukee Public Radio. We're back with more of Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North, and I'm glad to have your company. 2014 marks the centennial of the beginning of World War I. The horrors of that war are well documented. Years of trench warfare over a few feet of ground, the use of gas on the battlefield, and the more than 37 million total casualties, 10 million of them military deaths. That conflict also heralded the era of modern warfare with light caliber machine guns and modern tanks. It also marked the beginning of the end of the use of horses in war, as they proved no match to their mechanized foes. Hundreds of thousands of horses also died on the World War I battlefields between 1914 and 1918. The story of one such horse pressed into war service, Joey, and the boy who raised him and loved him, is the center of the sweeping drama War Horse. Created by the National Theatre of Great Britain, it opened in London to great acclaim in 2009 and has been playing ever since. Joey is brought to life by three puppeteers in a handmade articulated horse body that's made by handspring puppets from South Africa. It weighs 120 pounds and can be and is ridden. The effects are startlingly lifelike. War Horse is currently playing at the Marcus Center, and two members of the touring company are from Wisconsin. Andy Truschinski grew up in Marshall near Madison, and he's a graduate of UW-Whitewater. He plays Private Taylor, the battlefield confidant of the lead human character, Albert. Christy Ross Clausen from Appleton is behind the scenes. Well, above them, actually. We'll learn more in a minute. They join me in the studio now. Christy and Andy, welcome to Lake Effect. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Andy, let's start with you because you're on stage. Christy, we'll get to you because you're backstage. And okay. I do want to talk about the cool stuff that goes on back there. But Andy, you are Private Taylor in War Horse. This is an amazing show. Mm-hmm. And tell me about how you got involved in it.
Well, the show's been going on for a while. So there was like there's a whole history before I even became involved, including a year before they've been on the road already. But how I got involved was I just saw a general call posted up at another audition I was doing in New York, and I've always wanted to be involved in it. Even back to what was about 2009 when I was hanging out with a friend of mine, Tyler, and he's like, you got to see this video. You have to see this video. And I was like, okay, what is this? Another YouTube clip or something. And he showed me a clip of War Horse. And ever since then, I knew I was like, that's something I want to strive to do one day. And eventually, I mean, I saw that audition posting, and I made my way toward it, and it just kind of got lucky, I guess. Daniel Swee, the casting director, liked what I did for the first audition, had me come back in, and then Sarna Lapine, who's the director, had me come in another time after that, and then I got the call from the agent on the way to a catering gig. And I got off the train, and right then, as I stepped off from the train, I saw the phone call from my agent. She's like, yeah.
You got the
you
job?
You got it, yeah.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
And when you went to Marshall High School, did you think that you were going to be back here at the Marcus Center stage doing something like this?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, the reason I remember where it solidified for me that I want to be an actor is I remember I watched In the Name of the Father with Daniel Day-Lewis. And maybe, I guess, early on it was mostly like, I want to do movies, I want to do movies. And then I got into UW-Whitewater and plays became the thing for me. I've always strived to tell great stories. And whenever one comes across my path, I try my hardest to get involved in it. And, you know, thankfully I'm here.
Well, and you used to study with someone that has sat across from me at this desk, too. And that's Angela Iannone, who's mm-hmm. a wonderful actress herself and playwright.
Yeah.
And so did the training at Whitewater set you up?
Oh, absolutely. I had no idea what I was doing before I went to school. I mean, I did some good things with Marshall High School. We had a very small theater program there, but when I went to Whitewater, I learned, of course, all the basics and the general things about theater and acting. But I remember Angela, she really helped me out with what I needed to learn, like what it took to be a professional, what it took to be involved in the business aspect of things. But most importantly, she was really good at teaching people how to be alive on stage and being present and being able to just be there for your scene partner. And that's what I latch onto now.
What's interesting in this show, of course, is some of the scene partners are actually puppeteers in puppets. And so you're dealing with a level of almost it's like a double layer mm-hmm. of, you know, the puppeteers are not reacting to you. They're reacting to you through the device itself.
Right.
How is that as an actor?
It's pretty miraculous how it happens. I mean, being able to see what they do as actors, as puppeteers, is nothing short of a miracle, because they are creating life on stage. And there's not very many opportunities, maybe even zero, for a lot of people to see such a thing like that. But being able to have that every day on stage, especially with the part I played, David Taylor's the confidant to the main character, Albert. Albert gets – that's most of his acting is with a horse. And in a lot of ways, it is like acting with a scripted dialogue from another actor, because they'll give you a different take on how they'll nuzzle you or something as a horse, and then you can then play off that. And like I said, there's something miraculous about that.
And watching it, yeah. I have to say, it was amazing to see the way the human actors worked with the puppeteers and the puppets themselves, because you really felt that was a real entity mm-hmm. on stage. That wasn't it wasn't fake.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
Well, because like yes, the puppet is the middle part of it all, but you are – just like as you're acting with someone with scripted dialogue, you're basing what you're going to say based on how they have said their line or how they look at this certain moment. It's the same way that you're going to do with how the puppeteers will move that puppet towards you. You'll take that on as yourself as well. And it's really fun because it's always an ongoing dialogue, and it will be different every night because – not only that, but there's different teams of horses as well. So you get a different head puppeteer who decides to be soft and gentle when it walks towards you. The other one kind of like will yeah. trudge towards you a little bit more.
Well, Christy, you are backstage yes. in all of this, and you're doing lighting on this, right?
I am. And actually, I'm at the proscenium line and a tower 25 feet in the air during
oh my
the performance.
Goodness. So are you on a follow spot?
Yes, I run follow spot, and we sit on top of the sound towers for this show. So I get to see everything on stage, plus I get to see about half of the audience every night. I get two shows.
That's pretty amazing. So what's the audience reaction been like?
It's been wonderful. And one of the things I love about this show is that we have audience members of all ages. The official press stuff says ages 10 and up. But if you're a parent, you know if your kid is really interested in horses or interested in military history and they're 8 or 9, they're going to come and they're going to love it too. So I look out at the end of the show and I'll see people gently weeping and trying to hide their tears. And people will jump to their feet screaming and cheering right at the very end. And you'll see scenes that are touching scenes, and you can see the audience reaction to that. So it's been a really great education for me in watching the audience.
Well, and also I imagine it's fun for you. Well, you have to pay attention to what you're doing and making sure you're staying on the follow spot.
Yes.
But watching the differences, as Andy was saying, you know, between what this group of puppeteers is doing and how the action
yes.
unfolds on stage. For you, you're seeing it every night.
Yes. And it's interesting because I have my favorites that are a little bit easier for me to follow because they're a little more predictable. But then I also know that actors evolve as things happen over the course of their tour. They become a more codified group, and you can see how they're working together and how that evolves as we're going through the different cities. It's very enjoyable.
So how did you get involved in theater and technical theater specifically?
Well, my high school choir director told me there was no way I could make a living at it, and I set out to prove her wrong. I went to Lawrence University, majored in voice, worked in banking for a while, went back and got my teaching degree, and all along the way I've been working in technical theater. About 2 years ago, my husband, who had toured extensively, came home and said, "That's it, I'm done." And I said, "Okay, my turn." Within 3 days, I had a job offer. The next day, I got another job offer, and I've been out here ever since.
So what is it like touring through? We've talked to actors before about, you know, coming into a new town every day and or a new stage and having to get used to it. But from the technical side, I mean, you're responsible for loading everything in.
Yes.
And loading everything out and making sure it all works.
Yes.
So what is it like to be on the road with a tour like this where you're out for a year or two?
The difficult part of this tour is that we have so many complex elements and they have to be set in place in a very specific time frame. So it's very much like putting together a jigsaw puzzle in a new city every week. Literally. There are things that I can't do until the carpenters get the deck laid down. There are things that they can't do until we get some of the electrical cables run. And while we're doing that, the properties people are setting up their things. Because of how the tour is oriented, most of this is week-long sits. From the time I go to work on Sunday morning until midnight on Monday, I probably haven't had more than an hour or two of sleep. That's been the hardest part for me. But then we get a good night's sleep, come back in Tuesday, finish up, and the audience walks in the door Tuesday night, and it's all worth it.
So, yeah, Tuesday night was when I saw it at the press preview. How has the reaction here been compared to other places that you've both done the show?
It's been great everywhere we've gone, really. There's maybe nuances to it all, but the thing we commonly hear all the time is, "I can't believe that horse wasn't real." You know, that's the thing we get all the time. And people are enamored with this story, and I think that goes back to – you got to give that give credit to Michael Merpargo, who wrote the original book. He wrote an amazing story, and through it all, with the National Theater and Handspring, they've created something amazing that can stand the test of time and stand the test of location, because it's been seen by 4 million people throughout the world. And then specifically here with Milwaukee, it was. I mean, maybe it's a bad thing to want this kind of reaction, but it's kind of good to see people with tears in their eyes, because you know you're doing your job then. You know, you were telling a moving, captivating story.
And you're doing it kind of in hometown, and certainly in home state.
Oh, yeah. This feels home, like home to me. I've worked here before.
Well, I want to thank you both for coming in so early in the morning after not much sleep and after your opening night. I really appreciate it. And best of luck with the rest of the tour.
Thank you
very much.
Andy Truschinski grew up in Marshall, Wisconsin, and graduated from UW-Whitewater. He plays private tailor in the Broadway touring company of Warhorse. Electrician and follow spot operator Christy Ross Clausen is from Appleton. Warhorse can be seen at the Marcus Center through Sunday. There's more information plus photos from the show on our website, wuwm.com/lakeeffect. We'll take one last break, and then Pulitzer Prize winner Paul Harding is back with a novel on a tough subject. We'll talk with him next on Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Writer Paul Harding gave himself a tough act to follow. His first novel, Tinkers, won the Pulitzer Prize in 2010. It took place in northern New England, a locale he returns to in his latest novel, Enon. And the book's protagonist is the grandson of the lead character in the latest novel. But while the stories are far different, the stories both share Harding's impeccable writing skill and his fearless taking on of a subject that most of us would rather avoid, death. Harding, who was in Milwaukee in the fall, tells us that after spending 2 years immersed in the subject and in creating his latest book, it was nice to get out and talk about it in the real world.
The swings of the pendulum are long, and sometimes, you know, but I spent so long out on the road for Tinkers, and then I spent so long sort of practically becoming agoraphobic at my home in north of Boston, just totally immersed every single day in the composition and revision and revision and revision and revision of Enon. And you just spend so much time just with yourself inside the work But then when it's published, it's a great relief to sort of go back out into the world and you sort of get revivified by just going out and talking with people. And it's such an interesting thing because part of it is, you know, it's, the work of art is solitary and it's just you and the blank page or the blinking cursor or whatever. But, you know, then, you know, a work of art is essentially a gesture of fellowship. You know, so you want to go out and talk with people about reading and writing and art.
Is it at all scary, though, when you spent that much time basically creating something, in this case, that's quite dark but yet also hopeful?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Yet, you know, are you at all afraid that people are going to reject it?
It's inevitable. I mean, there's always that worry because you do have to go for long periods of time without sort of getting feedback. I mean, my agent gives me feedback and my editor, but that's sort of that's kind of the editorial process. You just wonder when it goes out into the world. You know, of course, you're afraid of rejection, but you have to have faith in the idea that if you think it's all right, there's going to be other people who like it. One of the things I always tell my writing students is don't write your books for people who won't like them. You know, because you can get into that, like, oh, well, this kind of person won't like the book. So then the problem is you don't write the real story. You write in anticipation of antagonistic readers, which is just that you won't write a good book that way. You know, the people who like my writing. It's a strange, it's almost tautological. But and then with Enon, yeah, it's I mean, when I first got the idea for it, I thought, oh, good, a spooky New England, you know, ghost story. And I wrote the first page of it and realized, no, this is just an incredibly sad tragedy. It's just a tragedy. It almost makes Tinkers look like a sitcom, you know.
Almost,
you know. But then that just, as a writer, was just this book presenting its own particular challenges. To avoid sentimentality, to avoid melodrama, to avoid, I don't know, just any of the predictable possible pitfalls of writing about that subject matter.
How much can we give away here?
You can give away everything. Spoiler. I mean, I'm solely interested in writing about character. So to me, plot is a predicate of character. So that if you read the first paragraph of Enon, you know what the whole story is. In the same way that it's the same is true of Tinkers. Mm-hmm. For me as an author, that's just a way of making sure that I don't do any three-card Monty stuff with plot. It's like all the cards are on the table and now the story must be in the telling.
The story is a very simple one and a very sad one, which is that a man loses his only child in a terrible car accident.
Mm-hmm.
It's the rest of the book is about how he does and doesn't deal with it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And as you say, it's character. It's mm-hmm. about who this man is.
Yeah, it's his attempt to be – well, to be equal to is maybe not quite the right word, but to how to survive it, how to, in from his point of view, live up to the memory of his daughter. He really becomes unraveled and it only gets worse. But he has the constant awareness throughout the whole book that he's unraveling and that he should not be unraveling and that in some ways he feels that unraveling is a betrayal of the memory of his daughter. And so it makes it all the more acute and more painful, but also then all the more imperative for him to try to pull himself back together as a way of doing justice to, you know, he loses his only child, but he's still a parent.
And it doesn't stop his life.
Right. That's right. Almost does. Right. And I mean, and that's so this, yeah. You know, it's not really a spoiler alert to say that one of the big question, the fundamental question for him becomes, am I through almost attrition, almost through committing an attenuated kind of suicide by abusing drugs and alcohol and all this sort of stuff that comes up? Is that just a way of trying to sort of split the difference and still just commit suicide? As difficult as it is for him to try to get out of that cycle that he finds himself in, it becomes imperative for him to like that's the difference between hope and hopelessness.
And again, like I said at the beginning of this, it's very, very dark, but there is that sense of hope that, you know, he's telling this story. So, you know, you're thinking,
right.
I'm hoping that, you know, when we get to the end, that he has found his way somewhere better.
Right. And the fact that it's first person and he's telling it in retrospect. And the fact that you trust Paul Harding not to pull the rug out from under you in any sort of tricky –
There isn't that three-card Monty.
There is no posthumous first-person narrative. He is alive. He's telling you the story. So somehow or another, he's come out on the other end of it. And as difficult as his story is and as modest, as it were, as the outcome is, it still is ultimately hopeful. And it's meant to be beautiful. And it's a book about love, you know. It's the threat of meaninglessness. It's the threat of total darkness. But just on the principle that, you know, the darkest hour is just before dawn. It's, you know, that just that idea of as dark as things get, that just makes this, even if it's the smallest amount of light that comes into, you know, that illuminates at the end, it's all the more precious and all the more piercing and all the more beautiful for the fact that it resists total darkness.
Yeah, total annihilation.
Right, right.
It's just not an option.
Yeah. I mean, for me as an artist and aesthetically and spiritually and blah, 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 it's just not. Flannery O'Connor, somebody says, you know, like novelists, you know, people without hope don't write novels. They don't make art. You know, so I think that's just a premise that I'm very open about.
What was it like being locked in with this story, though, for 2 years?
Oh, it's really intense. I mean, at first I thought, oh, goody, I've got a ghost story. I've got a New England ghost story on my hands. So it's Hawthorne and Poe and Emily Dickinson, and they're all certainly in there. But then I wrote the first paragraph of the book, and I realized this is a tragedy. This is just sort of this. I mean, there's no euphemistic way to get it. I'm writing a tragedy. And so I immediately just thought about, you know, every story takes part in a long tradition, and the, you know, this is Orpheus going down to the underworld. It's Persephone and Demeter. It's the parent going to the underworld and because he wants his daughter back, you know. So there's a long, rich history that I could rely on and think about. And also it was just a great way of actually disciplining the writing because I sort of feel like, why bother trying to write a book if everything's not at stake? So the real danger that I had to work to avoid but was became one of the satisfactions of the book, of the composition of the book avoiding, was that if the basic premise of the novel is a parent losing his only child, you take one false step in any direction and you have maudlin, melodramatic, sentimental hogwash. And I just was that won't do. So it just became a way of just disciplining the writing to just stay with this character. It's written in first person, so to stay with this character as he experiences every single moment and not lapse into writing about things abstractly. So he grieves, but the book is not about grief. The book is about Charlie Crosby. It's about the protagonist. Because the moment you lapse into just writing about grief in a kind of theoretical or abstract or psychological way, you know, objective way, the value of it as a work of art, it's a very slippery slope.
I think it distances you from the actual thing you're trying to talk about.
Right, which is a human being. I'm trying to render a human soul. And every human soul must be granted its own experience of itself. So you can't come up with an idea of like what grief is per se and then spend the novel forcing the character to experience the predetermined definition you have of grief. You obliterate his humanity. You insult the reader. And, you know, you write a crummy novel, basically.
Right. Which is the last thing we want.
That's the last thing I want, too. Believe yes. me, we all want the same thing, you know, a good work of art.
In addition to being locked in your room with a very dark but hopeful story, mm-hmm. this also came after Tinkers,
yeah,
which we
right.
mentioned, which won you all kinds of very deserved accolades. Was there a pressure there for you to try to somehow repeat that?
There is, but it's a worldly pressure, and this is the sort of distinction you just have to make or you'll just be paralyzed, which is there's a predictable phenomenon that comes along with if you have a first book and the first book is very popular, people are going to be ready for the sophomore slump. There's going to be as many people who don't like the book because it's Tinkers 2 or don't like it because it's not Tinkers 2 or whatever. And as a writer, you just can't think about any of that. I was going to be – no matter – how well or poorly Tinkers did, I was going to be trying to write the best possible second novel I could. So when Tinkers won the Pulitzer and there was this big kind of worldly phenomenon around it, I just had to make sure that every day when I climbed down into the fictional world of Enon that all of that just went away, you know, didn't have any of that in my mind. And in that sense, I, you know, it was very, very helpful that I, you know, have a wonderful agent and a wonderful editor at Random House who just abetted me in writing the book that I wanted to write and just like help keep the sort of aesthetic integrity of, you know, like the sort of just the realm of the book of Enon separate from kind of all the other worldly stuff that was going on around it. So, I mean,
And you feel it was successful?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, sometimes, you know, sometimes as a private citizen, when I'm lying in bed at 4 a.m, I think, oh, my goodness, I've got to do this. You know, how am I going to do? But that's just, I mean, that's inevitable. But again, it's just then the minute, you know, you put your writing hat on, all that stuff just – because every ounce of energy or every brain cell that's distracted about what am I going to do, you know, following up that first novel or the second novel is something that's distracting you from what you should be rightly paying attention to, which is this guy, this book, his – what does he see right now? What does he feel right now? Where is he going? How does he feel? I mean, every single bit of your attention has to be devoted to the character at hand.
It's a wonderful book.
Oh, thank you.
It's so evocative, so beautiful, and so painful. It was so hard to go with him on that journey because you just kept – at least I kept feeling, oh, you know, I want – but then I knew he had to do what he had to do because otherwise, as you said, it would have been false.
Right.
If he had come out of it too soon, it would have felt like, oh, wait, that was too easy. You know?
Oh, yeah, right, yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I'm sure – or maybe not, but certainly as a reader, there were times where I thought, oh, just – you know, go there, but you know in real life that wouldn't happen.
Right. And then that's the deeper sense of, you know, I think a lot about John Keats and the formulation of truth is beauty and beauty is truth, which is that the book is finally beautiful and therefore generous and solicitous of the reader because its integrity comes from it staying true to its own subject and not pulling punches or not being euphemistic, not glossing over things so that as intense as this sort of journey with the protagonist might be, at the end you do feel joy and hope and you feel like you've just gone through a true experience, you know. My job as a writer is to blow your mind and to break your heart. And that's just by taking this human life seriously and by also basically saying yes to it, you know. Wallace Stevens, the poet, said that poetry is essentially saying yes to this world and our place in it. And that's what I feel like my job and my natural disposition is for every book that I write.
Paul Harding, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Paul Harding's latest novel is Enon. His previous book, Tinkers, won the 2010 Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. Harding, who lives near Boston, was in Milwaukee last fall, and he spoke with us then. Our interview with him first aired in early December. You can hear Paul Harding read from Enon at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks, as always, for tuning in today. Be sure to be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. It's on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next.